This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Undertaking of Heart and Mercy, written by Megan Bannon, read by Michael Gallagher and Roshni Lamino.
Chapter 1. It was always a gamble, dropping off a body at Birdsill & Son Undertakers, but this morning, the Bride of Fortune favored Hart Ralston. Out of habit, he ducked his head as he stepped into the lobby so that he wouldn't smack his forehead on the doorframe. Bold-colored paintings of the Deaf Gods, the Salt Sea, the Warden, and Grandfather Bones decorated the walls in gold frames. Two green velvet armchairs sat in front of a walnut coffee table, their whimsical lines imbuing the room with an upbeat charm. Vintage coffee bean tins served as homes for pens and candy on a counter that was polished to a sheen. This was not the somber, staid lobby of a respectable place like Cunningham's funeral services. This was the appalling warmth of an undertaker who welcomed other people's deaths with open arms. It was also blessedly empty, save for the dog draped over one of the chairs. The mutt was scratching so furiously at his ribs, he didn't notice that his favorite tannery and marshal had walked through the front door. Hart watched in delight as the mongrel's back paw sent a cyclone of dog hair whirling through a shaft of sunlight before the bristly fur settled on the velvet upholstery. "Good boy, Leonard," said Hart, knowing full well that Mercy Birdsong did not want her dog wallowing on the furniture. At the sound of his name, Leonard perked up and wagged his nubbin tail. He leaped off the chair and hurled himself at Hart, who petted him with equal enthusiasm. Leonard was an ugly beast, half boxer, half the gods knew what, brindle-coated, eyes bugging and veined, jowls hanging loose. In any other case, this would be a face only his owner could love. But there was a reason Hart continued to patronize his least favorite undertaker in all the border towns that clung to the hem of the tannery and marshal's West Station like beggar children. After a thorough round of petting and a game of fetch with the tennis ball Leonard unearthed from underneath his chair, Hart pulled his watch out of his vest pocket and, seeing that it was already late in the afternoon, resigned himself to getting on with his job. He took a moment to doff his hat and brush back his overgrown blonde hair with his fingers. Not that he cared how he looked, not at Birdsall & Son, at any rate. As a matter of fact, if he had been a praying man, he would have begged the Mother of Sorrows to have mercy on him, no pun intended. But he was not entirely a man, not by half, much less one of the praying variety. So he left religion to the dog. "Pray for me, Leonard," he said before he pinged the counter bell.
"Pop, can you get that?"
Mercy's voice called from somewhere in the bowels of Birdsall & Son, loudly enough so that her father should be able to hear her, but softly enough that she wouldn't sound like a hoyden shouting across the building. Hart waited and waited. "I swear," he muttered as he rang the bell again. This time, Mercy threw caution to the wind and hollered, "Pop the bell!" But silence met this request, and Hart remained standing at the counter, his impatience expanding by the second. He shook his head at the dog. "Salt fucking sea, how does your owner manage to stay in business?" Leonard's nubbin started up again, and Hart bent down to pet the ever-loving snot out of the boxer mix.
"I'm so sorry,"
Mercy said, winded, as she rushed from the back to take her place behind the counter.
"Welcome to Birdsall & Son. How can I help you?"
Hart stood up and up and up, towering over Mercy as her stomach, hopefully, sank down and down.
"Oh, it's you," she said,
the words and the unenthusiastic tone that went with them dropping off her tongue like a lead weight. Hart resisted the urge to grind his molars into a fine powder. "Most people start with hello."
"Hello, heartache," she sighed.
"Hello, merciless." He gave her a thin, venomous smile as he took in her oddly disheveled appearance. Whatever else he might say about her, she was usually neat as a pin, her bright-colored dresses flattering her tall, buxom frame,
and her equally bright lipstick meticulously applied to her full lips. Today, however, she wore overalls, and her olive skin was dewy with sweat, making her red, horn-rimmed glasses slide down her nose. A couple of dark curls had come loose from the floral scarf that bound up her hair, as if she'd stuck her head out the window while driving full speed across a waterway.
"I guess you're still alive, then," she said flatly.
"I am. Try to contain your joy." Leonard, who could not contain his joy, jumped up to paw Hart's stomach, and Hart couldn't help but squeeze those sweet jowls in his hands. What a shame that such a great dog belonged to the worst of all undertaking office managers.
"Are you here to pet my dog, or do you actually have a body to drop off?"
A shot of cold humiliation zinged through Hart's veins, but he'd never let her see it. He held up his hands as if Mercy were leveling a pistol crossbow at his head, and declared with mock innocence, "I stopped by for a cup of tea. Is this a bad time?" Bereft of adoration, Leonard leaped up higher, mauling Hart's ribs.
"Leonard, get down."
Mercy nabbed her dog by the collar to drag him upstairs to her apartment. Hart could hear him scratching at the door and whining piteously behind the wood. It was monstrous of Mercy to deprive both Hart and her dog of each other's company. Typical.
"Now then, where were we?"
she said when she returned, propping her fists on her hips, which made the bib of her overalls stretch over the swell of her breasts. The square of denim seemed to scream, "Hey, look at these, aren't they fucking magnificent?" It was so unfair of Mercy to have magnificent breasts.
"You're dropping off a body, I assume?" she asked.
"Yep, no key."
"Another one? This is our third indigent this week."
"More bodies mean more money for you. I'd think you'd be jumping for joy."
"I'm not going to dignify that with a response. I'll meet you at the dock. You do know there's a bell back there, right?"
"I prefer the formality of checking in at the front desk."
"Sure you do."
She rolled her eyes, and Hart wished they'd roll right out of her unforgivably pretty face. "Does no one else work here? Why can't your father do it?" Like a gift from the Bride of Fortune, one of Roy Birdsall's legendary snores galloped through the lobby from behind the thin wall separating it from the office. Hart smirked at Mercy, whose face darkened in embarrassment.
"I'll meet you at the dock," she repeated through gritted teeth.
Hart's smirk came with him as he put on his hat, sauntered out to his auto dock, and backed it up to the dock. "Are you sure you're up for this?" he asked Mercy, as he swung open the door of his duck's cargo hold, knowing full well that she would find the question unbearably condescending. As if to prove that she didn't need anyone's help, least of all his, she snatched the dolly from its pegs on the wall, strode past him into the hold, and strapped the sailcloth-wrapped body to the rods with the practiced moves of an expert. Unfortunately, this particular corpse was extremely leaky, even through the thick canvas. Despite the fact that he had kept it on ice, the liquid rot wasn't completely frozen over, and Mercy wound up smearing it all over her hands and arms and the front of her overalls. Relishing her horror as it registered on her face, Hart sidled up to her, his tongue poking into the corner of his cheek. "I don't want to say I told you so, but..." She wheeled the corpse past him, forcing him to step out of the auto dock to make room for her.
"Heartache, if you don't want my help, maybe you should finally find yourself a partner."
The insinuation lit his Mercy fuse, which was admittedly short. As if he would have any trouble finding a partner if he wanted one, which he didn't. "I didn't ask for your help," he shot back. "And look who's talking, by the way." She halted the dolly and pulled out the kickstand with the toe of her sneaker.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"It means I don't see anyone helping you either." He fished inside his black vest for the paperwork she would need to complete in order to receive her government stipend for processing the body, and he held it out to her. He had long since learned to have his end all filled out ahead of time, so that he didn't have to spend a second longer in her presence than was necessary. She wiped one hand on the clean fabric over her ass before snatching the papers out of his hand. Without the consent of his reason, Hart's own hands itched with curiosity. wondering exactly how the round curves of her backside would feel in his grasp. His brain was trying to shove aside the unwanted lust when Mercy stepped into him and stood on her tiptoes. Most women couldn't get anywhere near Hart's head without the assistance of a ladder, but Mercy was tall enough to put her into kissing range when she stood on the tips of her red canvas shoes. Her big brown eyes blazed behind the lenses of her glasses, and the unexpected proximity of her whole body felt bizarrely intimate as she fired the next words into his face. "Do you know what I think, heartache?" He swallowed his unease and kept his voice cool. "Do tell, Merciless."
"You must be a pathetically friendless loser to be this much of a jerk."
On the word jerk, she poked him in the chest with the emphatic pointer finger of her filthy hand, dotting his vest with brown rot and making him stumble onto the edge of the dock. Then she pulled down the gate before he could utter another word, letting it slam shut between them with a resounding clang. Hart stood teetering on the lip of the dock in stunned silence. Slowly, insidiously, as he regained his balance, her words seeped beneath his skin and slithered into his veins. "I will never come here again unless I absolutely have to," he promised himself for the 100th time. Birdsall and Son was not the only official drop-off site for bodies recovered in Tanria without ID tags. From now on, he would take his keyless cadavers to Cunningham's. But as he thought the words, he knew they constituted a lie. Every time he slayed an indigent drudge in Tanria, he brought the corpse to Birdsall and Son Undertakers for a dog, because he was a pathetically friendless loser. He already knew this about himself, but the fact that Mercy knew it too made his spine bunch up. He got into his auto duck and drove to the station, his hands white-knuckling the wheel as he berated himself for letting Mercy get to him. Mercy, with her snotty, "Oh, it's you," as if a dumpster rat had waltzed into her lobby instead of Hart. Mercy, whose every word was a thumbtack spat in his face, pointy end first. The first time he'd met her, 4 years ago, she had walked into the lobby wearing a bright yellow dress, like a jolt of sunlight bursting through glowering clouds on a gloomy day. The large brown eyes behind her glasses had met his and widened, and he could see the word form in her mind as she took in the color of his irises, as pale and colorlessly gray as the morning sky on a cloudy day. Demigod. Now he found himself wondering which was worse, a pretty young woman seeing him as nothing more than the offspring of a divine parent, or Merciless Mercy loathing him for the man he was. Any hope he'd cherished of skulking back to his post in Sector W-38 unremarked vanished when he heard Chief McGuire's voice call to him from the front door of the West Station, as if she had been standing at the blinds in her office, waiting to pounce. "Marshal Ralston?" His whole body wanted to sag at the sound of Alma's voice, but he forced himself to keep his shoulders straight as he took his pack out of the passenger seat and shut the door with a metallic clunk. "Hey, Chief.
Where you been?"
"Eternity. I took out a drudge in Sector W-38, but it didn't have a key. Decomp was so bad, I decided to bring him in early. Poor pitiful bastard." Alma scrutinized him over the steaming rim of her ever-present coffee mug, her aquamarine demigod eyes glinting in her wide brown face. Hart's lips thinned. "Are you implying that I'm a poor pitiful bastard?"
"It's not so much an implication as a stone-cold statement of fact."
"Hardly."
"You have no social life. You work all the time. You don't even have a place to hang your hat. You might put up in a hotel for a few nights, but then you come right back here."
She jerked her thumb toward the mist, the cocoon of churning fog that formed the border of Tanria beyond the West Station.
"This shithole is your home. How sad is that?"
Hart shrugged. "It's not so bad."
"Says you. I assume you took the body to Cunningham's?"
"No." She raised an "I take no bullshit from you" eyebrow at him, before leaning on the hood of his duck.
and Hart frowned when she spilled a few drops of coffee onto the chipped blue paint. It was rusty enough as it was. She didn't need to go making it worse. Look, Ralston, we rely on the Undertakers. We need them to do their jobs so that we can do ours. Great, a lecture from his boss, who used to be his partner and his friend, who called him Ralston now. I know. You are aware of the fact that Roy Birdsall almost died a few months ago, right? Hart shifted his weight, the soles of his boots, grinding into the gravel of the parking lot. No. Well, he did. Heart attack or something. In theory, he's running the office, but Mercy's the one taking care of everything at Birdsall & Son. Boat making, body prep, all of it. So? His tone was petulant, but the memory of a disheveled Mercy with corpse rot smeared over her front made a frond of guilt unfurl in his gut. So if you're going to patronize Birdsall's, cut Mercy some slack and play nice. If you can't do that, go to Cunningham's, all right? Yep, fine. Can I go now? He adjusted his hat on his head, a clear signal that he was preparing to exit the conversation and get on with his job. But Alma held up her free hand. Hold on, I've been meaning to talk to you about something. Hart grunted. He knew what was coming. Don't give me that. You've gone through 3 partners in 4 years, and you've been working solo for months. It's too dangerous to keep going it alone, for any of us. She added that last bit as if this conversation were about Marshalls in general, rather than him specifically, but Hart knew better. I don't need a partner. She gave him a look of pure exasperation, and for a fraction of a second, Hart could see the old Alma, the friend who'd been there for him when his mentor, Bill, died. She'd dismissed him with a jerk of her head. Go on, but this conversation isn't finished. He'd walked a few paces toward the stables when Alma called after him. Come over for dinner one of these days, will you? Diane misses you. This peace offering was almost certainly Diane's doing, and he could tell that it was as hard for Alma to deliver her wife's invitation as it was for Hart to hear it. Yep, he answered, and continued on his way to the stables. But they both knew he wouldn't be standing on Alma and Diane's doorstep anytime soon. Although he and Alma had long since made peace on the surface of things, the old grudge hung in the air, as if Bill's ghost had taken up permanent residence in the space between them. Hart had no idea how to get past it, or if he wanted to. But it was painfully awkward to miss a friend when she was standing right behind him. It was worse to miss Diane. He almost never saw her anymore. The stables were dark compared to the brutal sunlight of Bouchon, and blessedly cooler, too. He went to the stalls to see which mounts were available. He knew it would be slim pickings at this time of day, but he was unprepared for how bad the pickings were. A gelding so young, Hart didn't trust it not to bolt at the first whiff of a drudge. An older mare he'd taken in a few times and found too slow and plodding for his liking. And salt liquor. Salt liquor was one of those equimaries that bolted for water every chance he got and maintained a constant, embittered opposition to anyone who dared to ride him. Some marshals liked him for his high-spiritedness. Hart loathed the beast. But of the 3 options, salt liquor was, sadly, the best choice. Wonderful, Hart griped at him. Salt liquor snorted, shook out his kelp-like mane, and dipped lower in his trough, blowing sulky bubbles in the water, as if to say, the feeling's mutual, dickhead. All at once, an oppressive sadness overtook Hart. It was one thing to dislike an equimaris. It was another to have the Equimaris hate him back. And honestly, who did genuinely like Hart these days? Mercy's barbed insult, which had followed him all the way from eternity, surfaced in his mind once more. You must be a pathetically friendless loser to be this much of a jerk. She had a point. Only a pathetically friendless loser would face his nemesis time and again to pet her dog for 5 minutes. Maybe I should suck it up and get another dog, he thought. But the second he entertained the idea, he knew he could never replace Gracie. And that left him with nothing but the occasional visit to Leonard. Hart knew that he needed to get to his post, but he wound up sitting against the stable wall, shrouded in shadows. As if it had a mind of its own, call it ancient muscle memory, his hand snaked into his pack and pulled out his old notebook and a pen. When he had first joined the Tanrian Marshals after his mother died, he used to write letters to her and slide them into Nimkillum boxes whenever he and his mentor, Bill, made their way to the station or to a town. Then, after Bill was killed, Hart wrote to him, too, mostly letters full of remorse. But he hadn't written to either of them in years, because at the end of the day, it wasn't like they could write back. And that was what he wanted, wasn't it? For someone, anyone, to answer? Poor, pitiful bastard, the blank page splayed across his thighs seemed to say to him now. He clicked open the pen and wrote, "Dear," hesitated, and then added the word, "friend." He had no idea how much time passed before he tore out the page, folded it into fourths, and got to his feet, relieving his aching knees. There was a similar relief in his aching chest, as if he'd managed to pour some of that loneliness from his heart onto the paper. Glancing about him to make sure he was unobserved as he crossed the stable yard, he walked to the station's Nimkillum box and slid the note inside, even though he was certain that a letter addressed to no one would never be delivered to anyone.
Chapter 2. Mercy cranked up berth number 5 and watched as the unfortunate man whom Hart Ralston had brought in the day before surfaced from the well, which had kept his body chilled at a steady 55 degrees overnight. He wasn't overly large, but he wasn't tiny either, and moving him onto the dolly would go easier with 2. "Zeddy, you there?" Mercy called hopefully up the basement stairs, but it was Pop who answered her, his voice too eager for her liking. "He's not in yet. Need help with something, Muffin?" "No. Nope. I'm good. I wanted to show Zeddy how to work that tricky kink in berth number 5's rope." It wasn't a lie, per se, but she didn't want Pop doing anything that required physical exertion, such as helping her move a corpse. He wasn't so great on stairs these days, either. His knees popped alarmingly with each step. After his heart attack 6 months ago, the doctor had said that he needed to retire, at least from the heavy-duty work of undertaking, which was why he was upstairs running the office in Mercy's stead, and she was down here, working as the interim undertaker until Zeddy was ready to take over, which, in theory, was happening this morning, if he ever showed up. Annoyed with her brother for being late on his first day as the official undertaker of Birdsall and Son, Mercy maneuvered the indigent's remains onto the dolly by herself, rolled the body into the lift by herself, added several more pounds to the counterbalance by herself, and pulled down on the lift rope by herself, hand over hand, until she felt it hit the end of the line. She liked the way her muscles worked, hefting and hauling, pushing and pulling, as if this job were the reason why the three mothers had made her bigger than nearly every other woman on the island of Bouchong, and taller than most men, too. Of course, there was one man who towered over her, or rather, one demigod. Too bad Hart Ralston's divine parentage came with a heaping spoonful of arrogance, so evident in the way he cocked his head and put his hands on his hips, drawing attention to their slimness. The way his rapier belt hung off them in the most irritatingly sexy way possible. It annoyed Mercy to no end that after years of putting up with that insufferable marshal, some primal inner instinct continued to think he looked good enough to eat. She locked the rope in place and whistled as she headed upstairs, the rubber soles of her red canvas shoes making a satisfying thud, thud, thud on the treads. Since Zeddy had yet to arrive, she decided that now would be a good time to broach the subject of her father's languishing to-do list. She popped her head into the office where Roy Birdsall sat at her old desk, his reading glasses propped inexplicably atop his bushy eyebrows. "I don't know if you remember my mentioning this last week, but we're out of cedar and larch, and now we're running low on salt, too, and urns. I'll write up the orders this morning as soon as I'm done balancing the books. I promise. Very, very, extremely low. And it wouldn't hurt to order more keys. We've had a run on unidentified bodies lately. Should I write this down? I'm old, but I'm not that old. I'll remember. Because I can write this down if you want. He shook his head with a grin. Sometimes you are just like your mother. Mercy knew this was the highest of compliments coming from the mouth of Roy Birdsall. She kissed his more salt-than-pepper curls and counted off the to-do list on her fingers. Cedar. Larch. Salt. Urns. And remember to order more keys. Pop saluted her, but the gesture was somehow less than reassuring. With that, Mercy left his office. She was about to head to the boatworks when she heard Horatio's familiar rapping at the front door, his talons clacking against the wood. I've got it, she called to her father on her way to the lobby to let in the Nim kill him. The owl stood on the welcome mat as he did every morning, 6 days a week, his white feathers garbed in a particularly dapper emerald waistcoat and silk trousers, an ensemble that seemed remarkably out of place in a dusty border town like Eternity. Ah, good morning, Miss Birdsall. Horatio hooted in a way that also said, I was once a messenger to the old gods, and yet you made me wait on this kitschy doormat. But Mercy found the owl's old-school hauteur charming, so she gave him her usual bright smile as he stepped his standard 3 paces into the lobby on his bare bird feet. He fished out a slim packet of letters from the tasteful, soft leather mailbag slung across his back and handed it to Mercy. I rather like this modern style you are trying on these days. I've never seen anyone make overalls work, yet here you are, the very picture. Mercy dimpled. A compliment from Horatio, even one sniffed with patronizing admiration, was cause for celebration. Her beloved dress collection had been gathering dust in her bedroom closet upstairs for 6 months now, but she found that her new coveralls and dungarees offered fashionable opportunities alongside their practicality. Thank you, she said, patting the floral scarf that bound up her hair as she took the daily death notices from the countertop and handed them over. Then she fished a coin from the bowl she kept behind the counter and gave it to the Nim Killam as well. Horatio sniffed at the silver glinting on the white feathers of his wing and was about to bid her good day when Mercy held up a folded piece of paper she found on top of the stack in her hand. There's been some kind of mistake, Horatio. This letter isn't addressed to Birdsall and Son. A mistake? I think not. The owl tugged up on a chain around his neck, and a pair of reading glasses popped out from beneath his waistcoat. He plunked them onto the end of his beak with the feathery tips of one wing as he took the paper from Mercy with the other. He studied the blank outer fold as if there were something to read there. Then he thrust the letter at her once more. As I said, it is for you. Mercy took the note, frowning at it in confusion. But there's no address. Yes, there is. Where? Horatio flapped a wing vaguely toward the paper in her hand. Still don't see it, said Mercy. Just because human beings can't see it doesn't mean it's not there, my dear. I should add that this missive is not addressed to Birdsall and Son. It is addressed to you, personally. To me? A thrill shivered up her spine. The only person who sent her non-business-related mail was her sister, Lillian, who sometimes found hilariously tacky postcards on the road. Who's it from? Goodness, how would I know? The same way you know it's for me? Horatio gave a tittering hoot. Darling, reading the direction is the sum total of my powers in that regard. Pesky privacy laws and all that. Which is a shame, I can tell you, for there are so many letters I would love to read prior to delivery. Are we quite finished here? Excellent. Ta-ta. Bye, Mercy replied absently. She stared down at the folded paper in her hand, bewildered, as she flipped the front door sign to open. Behind her, she heard the door to the kitchenette squawk on hinges in need of oiling and turned around in time to see Pop trying to sneak into his office with a steaming cup of coffee. No! Nope, Mercy said, pointing an accusatory finger at him. Pop sulked like a giant toddler. Ah, Muffin! You know what Dr. Galdamez said. Defeated, he went into the kitchenette to dump out his coffee as Mercy unfolded the note and read. Dear friend, I suspect that I'm writing to someone who doesn't exist. But if you do exist, and you're out there somewhere, I guess this letter is for you.
I have recently been informed that I'm a dickhead, by an Equimeris, no less. And before you go defending me, please know that it's true. I am a dickhead. I'm not sure when or how it happened, and I don't think I've always been a dickhead, yet here we are. I have to confess that there is one person in particular who brings out the complete and utter dickhead in me, and I wish I knew what to do about that. Do you have someone like this in your life? A person who rubs you the wrong way? And no matter how often you promise yourself that you will rise above it all, you let them goad you every single time? I hope you don't, for your sake. But if you do, my condolences. I've been trying to figure out why this person brings out the worst in me, and I have come to the following conclusion. Most days are just days, you know? Just me plodding through the hours between when I get up and when I go to bed. But whenever I'm around this one person, this individual who gets under my skin like no other, I feel more strongly the presence of an undeniable truth that is always there, lurking, hovering, waiting for me around every bend in the road. Loneliness. There. I said it. Technically, I wrote it, but committing it to ink makes it truer. I'm lonely. So this woman who very clearly does not like me reminds me that there are very few people left in this world who do. And my circumstances are such that I don't know how to solve that problem. Maybe that's why I keep putting myself in her crosshairs. Maybe there's a strange comfort in knowing that at least one person feels something for me, even if that feeling could best be described as hate. Well, this is a dismal letter. Sorry about that. For what it's worth, I feel better for having written it, to have applied the weight of my loneliness to a piece of paper, rather than to my own heart for a change. Thanks for that, my friend. I hope my words haven't weighed you down. Or are you lonely, too? Sincerely, a friend. Mercy gaped at the inexplicable pouring out of a heart that she held in her hand, from a person as real and substantial as the paper on which it had been written, but as fragile and easily torn, too. Who had sent it? And why had Horatio insisted that this letter was addressed to Mercy when the writer clearly didn't know who she was? The front door opened, and Mercy folded up the letter and shoved it into the pocket of her dungarees in time to see her brother, Zeddy, saunter into the lobby, brazenly hip in his green shirt and slim-cut pink pants, his golden curls perfectly disheveled, the picture of 20-year-old callowness. He carried a greasy bag with one hand while stuffing half a glazed donut into his mouth with the other. Like Mercy, he was tall, but unlike Mercy, he had inherited their mother's narrow frame and the ability to shovel food therein with little effect. "Why are you late?" Mercy asked him. "Because donuts!" He handed her the bag, which she opened so that she could inhale the fried perfection inside. It was hard to stay mad at anyone who brought her donuts. "Fair point, but we need to make sure Pop doesn't see these." As if on cue, their father stepped out of the kitchenette, sans coffee, and beamed when he saw his son in the lobby. "There's the graduate!"
"That's me!"
Zeddy smiled gamely as Mercy hid the bag of donuts behind her back, but there was a tightness to his mouth, a gritting of the teeth that planted a small seed of concern in Mercy's gut. She refused to let it take root, however, certain she must be imagining things.
"So, what are we up to on your first day as Undertaker?" Pop asked, clapping his big hands and rubbing them together in giddy anticipation.
"Zeddy is going to bathe, salt, and wrap the gentleman Marshall Ralston brought in yesterday, while you sit quietly at your desk and balance the books, per the doctor's orders."
"Oh, I thought maybe we'd start with boat making," said Zeddy.
"This one's keyless, so it'll be easy peasy."
Right.
Zeddy laughed nervously. Mercy chalked it up to first day jitters.
"I'll let you get to it."
Pop chucked his daughter affectionately on the chin and went back into the office. With her father safely out of the way, Mercy decided it would be acceptable to stop in the kitchenette to snarf down a donut before heading to the boatworks.
"How can the body be keyless?"
Zeddy asked her a few minutes later, through a mouthful of half-masticated fried dough.
"Don't you have to have an ID key to enter Tanria?"
"Legally, yes. But plenty of people sneak in to poach birds, dig up exotic plants, that kind of thing. There's a whole black market for Tanrian stuff." By now, Mercy had finished her crawler and was ready to get to work. But Zeddy grabbed another donut from the bag and took a bite.
So how do you know what to do with the body or where to send it?
We don't. All we can do is salt the remains, perform the incantations, and take them to the burial pits.
Gods, no wonder we're broke, Zeddy muttered before taking another bite.
Mercy bristled. These people deserve dignity at the end of life as much as anyone else. That's how we do things at Birdsall and Son.
But how can you stay in business if you're taking on unpaid work?
We, not me, she corrected him, as he shoved the remaining chunk of donut into his mouth. And it's not unpaid. I applied for the Indigent Processing Grant when the new Tanrian ID laws went into effect 4 years ago. Aside from Cunningham's, we're the only drop-off site for keyless bodies near the West Station, and we get paid a stipend every time a marshal delivers unidentified remains to us. At first, it didn't add up to much, but with the sheer number of people entering Tanria these days, indigent intake has become a steady revenue stream.
Good to know, Zeddy said with a distinct lack of enthusiasm, which was disappointing.
Mercy was proud of herself for having the foresight to apply for the grant 4 years ago. Well, there'll be plenty of time for you to learn the ins and outs of the finances, and that part of the business is mostly my job anyway. She patted his arm, brushing aside her wounded pride at the same time. Ready to do some bathing and salting and wrapping? Zeddy frowned at the greasy donut bag.
Maybe I should digest first?
Mercy laughed at his joke. Surely he was joking. And led him to the boatworks. But by the time they had donned their goggles and gloves and rubber aprons, her brother's tawny skin had taken on a ghostly pallor. She almost offered to get the body out of the lift on her own, but she stopped herself. The business was called Birdsall and Son, and the son had finally come home to take over what their father had begun. It was time for her to stop babying him and let him get his hands dirty. Go ahead and get him on the prep table.
Right.
She watched as Zeddy rolled the dolly out of the lift and clumsily hoisted the body in its stained shroud onto the table over the drain in the floor. He was clearly holding his breath, and by the time he'd finished, he had turned positively green. She could make neither head nor tail of his squeamishness. Maybe they used dummies instead of corpses in his training program? Are you up for salting and wrapping the body? She asked him. A bead of sweat trickled down his temple.
No, I think I should watch you do it first to make sure I learn how to do things the way Pop wants them done.
All right. She studied his pinched face. Zeddy had always been timid around the dead. But surely 3 years of working toward his degree in funerary rites and services would have solved that problem. Shoving aside her misgivings, she went about unwrapping the body. The decay is extensive, but you can see that this man was strangled, which is a blessing. Judges often bite into their victims' throats to kill them before taking over their bodies, as I'm sure you know. Zeddy swallowed and nodded. Mercy cut away what remained of the man's clothes, revealing the bloodless skin of his abdomen. See here? There's a wound where Marshal Ralston ran the corpse through the appendix, which, as you know, is the seat of the human soul and the point of Drudge infection. But I always double-check to be on the safe side. She picked up the scalpel she kept on hand for this purpose, made a precise cut to open the lower abdomen, and fished through the intestines until she found the appendix, punctured as it ought to be. She sliced into it again for good measure, in time for Zeddy to bend over the sink basin behind him and lose the contents of his stomach therein. He fled from the boatworks, the soles of his canvas high tops squeaking on the clean linoleum floor in his haste, and Mercy was left to loom over the corpse, bewildered, holding the scalpel in midair. She set it down on the tray, washed her hands in the sink, rinsing Zeddy's mess down the drain at the same time, and followed his trail until she found him sitting at the small table in the kitchenette with his head buried in his arms. The now empty donut bag was crumpled up next to his elbow.
Zeddy?
He sat up, furiously wiping his eyes with the backs of his hands, and Mercy's whole chest ached in sympathy.
What's wrong? She asked.
I need to tell you something.
Okay.
She sat down in the chair opposite him and patted his arm.
I'm listening.
He squeezed his hands between his knees, as miserable and pathetic as a puppy stuck outside the screen door in the pouring rain.
So, when I was at school, I didn't exactly follow the coursework for funerary rites and services.
That seed of concern in her gut sprouted, grew, and bloomed.
What? She asked, not certain she wanted the answer.
I flunked Intro to Death Rituals my first semester, and I had to drop Intro to Boatmaking because, as it turns out, I'm allergic to mahogany. That would explain all those rashes I used to get as a kid. Remember?
Mother of Sorrows, Mercy breathed at him in disbelief. Then what in the Salt Sea have you been studying for the past 3 years?
Zeddy shrank into the chair, caving in on himself.
Ancient Midoran philosophy?
Are you kidding me?
I wasn't married to it, but I didn't know what else to do.
And you're just now telling me this?
Over the course of those 7 words, Mercy's voice shot up several octaves.
Shh!
Zeddy sprang to his feet and closed the door to the kitchenette.
I'm telling you now. Does Pop know?
No. Gods, no.
Please don't tell him, Merce. How am I supposed to keep this from him? I think I'm going to pass out.
She put her head between her knees and took deep breaths, gulping down air and steaming up her glasses until she got a grip on herself and could sit up again.
It's okay. We can fix this. You don't have to use mahogany. Oak's better anyway.
She looked hopefully at her brother, but that hope quickly dwindled as she watched him lean against the door with an air of tragedy.
The job's not that bad once you get used to it,
she assured him. Begged him, more like.
I will never get used to it. And you're right. It's not bad. It's terrible.
No, it isn't.
Zeddy clutched the sides of his head, his curls splaying out between his fingers.
I know I should have said something before now, but every time I tried to tell Pop, I chickened out. I mean, how could I do that to him after all he's done for me? So I thought, okay, Zeddy, how bad can it be? Give it a shot. But that shot lasted all of 5 seconds. God's tits, this is a fucking disaster.
It's not like this job was a giant surprise. You've always known that undertaking gets passed down from father to son. It's been that way since the days of the old gods, and Pop's had this all laid out for you since you were born. You'd take over as undertaker, and I'd stay on as your office manager. Things are a mess, Zeddy. If you don't step up, that's it. Birdsall and Son is done. Finished. Over.
I know, but I'm telling you, I can't do it. I won't.
Well, what else are you going to do with your life?
Not spend it with dead people.
The words were a slap to Mercy's face. Her eyes welled up with hot tears of frustration. But she could see that there was no cajoling him into the undertaking business, not as he melted against the door in mute misery anyway. Defeated, she rubbed her forehead with both hands.
What are we going to do?
I don't know. Please don't tell Pop. Or Lil, either. I don't trust her to keep her mouth shut.
They're going to figure it out.
I know. I'll tell Pop. I'll tell both of them, I swear. But I'd like to have a plan for my future in place before I do. Can you cover for me until then?
Mercy wondered if her brother understood that he had pulled the rug out from underneath her. She'd worked her tail off for 13 years to help Pop keep Birdsall and Son up and running for Zeddy's benefit. And now, he was about to smash it to smithereens. She wanted to say, what about me? But what right did she have to guilt Zeddy into a job? A vocation, really, that made him miserable. She couldn't do that to this brat she'd adored since the day he was born. He came to kneel in front of her.
Please? Pretty please?
He begged her. And she cracked like an egg.
Ugh, fine. I'll keep your secret. For now. But at least give boatmaking a shot if you can't handle the bodies. You owe Pop that much. As for telling him about the philosophy degree, make it soon. And until then, you have to help me do all the things that don't involve dead bodies. And you have to help me keep Pop in line, too, because he keeps trying to do stuff the doctor says he can't do anymore. Deal?
Yes, absolutely. Deal. You are the literal best sister ever.
Be sure to mention that to Lil the next time she's in town,
Mercy joked weakly, as Zeddy hugged her hard, chair and all. She had already forgotten about the strange letter, so she paid no attention to the crinkling of paper in her pocket as her brother squeezed the breath out of her.
Chapter 3. Hart had been back in the field for all of 26 hours when the Nimkillum showed up with his obnoxious knock-knock mail delivery outside the barracks. More than enough time for Hart to reconsider and regret his decision to write and send that letter. What if the Nimkillum who collected it out of the box read it, or worse, had a way of returning it to the sender? What if the letter was actually delivered to somebody? What if someone, anyone, figured out that he was the one who had written it? And yet, as he stepped out into the Tanrian gloaming to find Bessarius standing by the deck chairs, Hart couldn't help but hope that the letter in the rabbit's paw was a response to the one he'd sent out into the world like a message in a bottle.
"How you doing?" the Nimkillum said in his incongruously deep voice.
His red vest was ratty, but the gold hoop in his long ear gleamed like new. "Banneker and Ellis are on rounds," Hart told him, since he knew the delivery probably wasn't for him, and he didn't want to be disappointed.
"Good to see you too, sunshine. It's for you, from the chief."
Hart took the proffered letter and frowned at it, more disappointed than he had thought he'd be. When he realized that the rabbit was still standing there, he said,
"Thanks. You're welcome."
Bessarius didn't move, so Hart did, going inside the barracks to read the note. But he didn't fail to hear the Nimkillum's muttered,
"Asshole,"
behind him as he shut the door. Alma hadn't bothered stuffing the letter into an envelope, so Hart unfolded it and took in the message, delivered succinctly in Alma's neat, unfussy script. "Marshal Ralston, your presence is required in my office tomorrow afternoon, 1 o'clock sharp. See you then. A." It was unsettling, the odd balance of former partners and friends turned boss and underling and sort of friends but sort of not friends. Hart scanned the terse message again, trying to read between the lines. There was the arm's length distance of calling him Marshal Ralston and the friendly overture of signing off with her initial. This was why he didn't go over to her house anymore. He never could figure out exactly where he stood with her. Their conversation the day before about Hart's working solo was no small cause for concern. And yet as he lay in the too small bunk that night, it wasn't his impending meeting with Alma that kept him up. It was the letter he'd sent to no one. He continued to fret over the wisdom of pouring out his heart onto a piece of paper, so much so that by the time he returned to the station the following day, he felt sick to his stomach. He arrived a half hour early to resupply, so that he could escape as soon as Alma was finished with him. But the chief's voice cut across the commissary at 12:45. "Marshal Ralston." He looked up from the shelf lined with canned fruit and found her standing by the door. She jerked her head toward the hallway behind her. Hart pulled his watch from his pocket.
"The meeting's not till 1.
May as well get it over with. Come on. And don't say I didn't warn you this was coming."
His stomach soured more as he met her at the door and fell into step beside her.
"So, you're foisting another partner on me?"
"In a manner of speaking."
"Meaning?"
Alma stopped outside the closed door of her office and studied Hart. One corner of her mouth twisted into a grin.
"What?"
he asked, disconcerted.
"You're fantastic at what you do."
A compliment. He was not expecting that, and he didn't know what to do with it. Warmth spread across his chest.
"Which is why I have decided that you owe it to the profession to pass along your wealth of knowledge," she continued.
And all at once, Alma's grin struck him as menacing.
"An apprentice?"
She might as well ask him to learn glassblowing or change a baby's diaper. He couldn't imagine how she came to think this was a good idea. But there she was, demigod eyes shining with amusement as she nodded in response.
"No, hard no," he said. "It's time for you to pay it forward."
Before he could sputter another protest, she opened her office door. A painfully young man was waiting for them, sitting in the chair across from Alma's desk, his knees bobbing up and down with nervous energy. Actually, the term young man was stretching it. The kid probably didn't need to shave the black fuzz off his upper lip on a regular basis yet. And there was something about the close crop of his tightly coiled hair that made him seem younger than he was,
as if his mother was the one calling the shots on his hairstyle and buying him socks and underwear. He had a stoppard bottle tattooed on his forearm, which meant that his appendix had burst at some point, and a temple votary had had to preserve his soul in the spirit vessel inked on his skin so that it wouldn't go sailing off on the salt sea before his body died. Marshals without their appendixes tended to be risk-taking, showboating nightmares and heart's experience. The kid leaped to his feet, clutching a recruitment brochure that said, "So you wanna be a Tanrian marshal?" as he gaped up at Hart. "Dang, you're tall." "This is not happening," Hart thought. "I refuse to do this." He gave the applicant a cool squint, the one that froze the blood of most miscreants. But the kid was so guileless, it had no discernible effect on him. "All right," Alma told the young man. "Have at it, and Godspeed to you." The kid looked up at Hart with eager eyes, the warm brown of a well-worn leather book cover. "I know you're a busy man, Marshal Ralston, so I'll get right to the point. I hear you've been working solo for a while." "Yep. Marshaling is hard work. It goes easier with two, am I right?" "This is what you call getting to the point?" The kid licked his lips. "I need a job, and you need a partner. You are at least 50% incorrect." "It's a win-win." "And that is 100% incorrect." The kid's eyes went from eager to pleading. "Hear me out. My dad died in an auto duck wreck last year, and it's been hard on us, especially my mom. She had to pick up an extra job to keep us afloat. She wanted me to go to school for dentistry, but when my appendix burst a couple of months ago and I managed not to die, I thought, here's my chance. I could join the Tanrian Marshals and make serious bank and help my mom send my sisters and my brother to college. I mean, do you know what a marshal makes?" Hart didn't answer the question. He was too busy remembering his own mother, used and left by an uncaring god to raise Hart on her own. At least this kid's dad had been a decent father. "I'm strong and I work hard," the recruit wheedled, as if he could sense the way Hart was caving. "And hey, since I don't have an appendix, I can't become a drudge, right?" "But you can be killed by one," Hart pointed out, reminding himself that he neither needed nor wanted an apprentice. "This isn't a game. The more people pour into Tanria, the more bodies there are for drudges to take over. And it gets worse year after year. Marshals make serious bank because every time we step onto Tanrian soil, we put our lives on the line. It's dangerous work, and you're only a kid." The kid in question stood up straighter and puffed out his chest. "I'm 19. How old were you when you started marshaling? Who mentored you?" Hart clamped his lips as he recalled his 16-year-old self, gawky, skinny, sullen, scared, alone. This guy was hitting every sore spot he owned. "Hold on a sec," Alma told the would-be marshal before she hauled Hart into the hallway and pointed a stern finger at his face. "I want you to remember who you were when you were 19 years old. I want you to remember what Bill meant to you then. You could be to this young man what Bill was to you." All the air whooshed out of Hart's lungs. Alma hadn't uttered Bill's name in his presence since their argument 4 years ago. And now here she was, playing it like a trump card. What rankled him was that it was working. He should be tearing into her. Instead, he glanced into the office at the kid, whose raw hopefulness twisted Hart's conscience into a pretzel. "You could be to this young man what Bill was to you." For a moment, for one heartbeat of his life, he wanted it to be true. Wanted it enough to let out a gusty breath of defeat and lean against the door jamb to give the kid a long, appraising look. It was like staring into a mirror, the reflection of his younger self challenging him to be a better man than he had become. "What did you say your name was?"
"Penrose Duckers, but my friends call me Pen."
Both answers sounded more like questions than statements of fact, a hint of uncertainty that tightened the pretzel in Hart's gut and strengthened his bewildering resolve to make what was likely to be a very bad decision.
Well, I'm not your friend, Duckers. Come on, we need to get you outfitted. Duckers' whole body lit up with puppy-like excitement.
Wait, what? Am I hired?
Hart marveled at the dingy ceiling of Alma's office, as if the reason behind his agreement to take on an apprentice was sticking to the strip of flypaper that dangled near the window. Looks like it.
Yes, I won't let you down, Mr. Hart, what should I call you?
Sir, Hart answered dryly.
Right.
Duckers grabbed Hart's hand and pumped it with enthusiasm.
Yes, sir.
Alma beamed at him, and for some strange reason, his stomach didn't hurt anymore. Hart and Duckers sat atop their Equimaries, inches away from the mist at the western checkpoint, where an archway made of metal and a bewildering array of pistons and cogs stood against the churning fog of the Tanrian border. The portals that punched a doorway into the mist at each of the four cardinal points of Tanria never ceased to impress Hart. He'd gone in and out of them for 19 years, but he had no idea how they worked. The engineers had a great enough command of the machinery to make repairs from time to time, and pirated knockoffs were becoming more and more abundant. But the only person who truly understood the ins and outs of the portals was the man who had created them 25 years ago, a reclusive scholar at the University of Quindaro named Dr. Adam Lee. Hart had met him once when he came to examine the portal at the West Station. He was a petite, fine-boned man, but although the top of Dr. Lee's head didn't reach Hart's shoulder, he was the most intimidating person Hart had ever met. No one could match that kind of brilliance, which would explain why the pirated portals used to illegally enter Tanria frequently collapsed or exploded. The engineer on duty at the West Station's portal pushed a couple of buttons, spun a dial, and pulled on the crank. Duckers gawked at the mist within the archway as it swirled and thinned into nothing more than a gauzy, opaque curtain with a shadowy silhouette of the Tanrian landscape barely visible on the other side.
So I ride through this?
Yep.
Just ride on through, easy as pie.
Yep. Hart waited for the kid to get moving as the marshals assigned to the checkpoint snickered. But Duckers continued to sit on his docile mare and frown at the dense fog without going anywhere.
Are there any drudges in this stuff?
He asked Hart. Nope, they can't get into the mist, and there are marshals stationed on the other side, so you usually don't see them close to the portals either.
Usually?
Hart had no intention of sitting here all day. He had already lost most of the afternoon as it was. So he grabbed the reins from Duckers and dragged Ryder and Equimaris through the mist with him. The thick silence of the fog seeped into the marrow of his bones as they crossed, a sensation to which he was accustomed by now, but had never learned to love. Duckers was far from loving it either. His dark complexion had taken on a sickly cast by the time they made it through.
Holy shit, he sputtered.
There, Hart said, tossing the reins back. Easy as pie. Duckers looked like he was going to be sick all over the scaly purple hide of his mount, but when he finally noticed his surroundings, his lips slackened with awe.
Whoa.
It had been a long time since Hart had viewed the landscape of Tanria with anything resembling wonder. Now he gazed at the bizarrely symmetrical triangles of mountains in the distance, and the sweeping pink hills rolling before them. He listened to the lava-like burbling of an ambrosial brook, and the jarring trill of birds and the comical burps of animals that lived and died only in this strange land, an off-kilter world created by imprisoned gods with nothing better to do. Hart tried to appreciate it once more as he watched Duckers take it all in with new eyes. It didn't work. Tanria was simply a place to him now, no different from any other place. He thought of what Alma had said about this shithole being his home. It wasn't a shithole, but it wasn't his home either. Duckers, on the other hand, took it all in with enthusiasm, and his smile grew bigger and bigger. He looked back at the portal and laughed.
Holy shit!
Yep, Hart agreed. The portal was still there, with a bored Tanrian marshal stationed on either side of it. But the archway appeared to be a freestanding door in the middle of nowhere, as if the mist weren't there at all. The scrubby desert landscape of Bushong was clearly visible from inside Tanria, but completely unattainable without the portals. Duckers pressed a hand against the solid yet invisible border and watched a tumbleweed blow past on the other side.
So people couldn't see in, but the old gods could see out?
Yep.
Dang.
Guess the new gods wanted the old gods to see what they were missing. This had always struck Hart as being cruel. But then, it wasn't like he had a high opinion of the gods, old or new, anyway. He shoved aside the moribundity and nodded at his apprentice. You ready?
Yes, sir.
Duckers grinned at him, game for anything. And Hart realized, to his amazement, that he kind of liked this kid and didn't mind his company as much as he thought he would. Not going to fall off your Equimaris, are you?
I don't think so, but I'm a city man. I'm not used to Equimaries.
Well, get used to them, because autoducts don't work here. Neither do transistors, gas stoves, firearms, you name it. Anything that didn't